How much time do we need to allow for
that? Okay.
Today's February 14th, 2017. This is Joint Committee on Ways and Means Subcommittee on Human Services. Today we're going to say continuation of our public hearing on House Bill 5026. And then during the last 15 minutes, we're going to do a work session on a grant application. So with that, I'd also like the committee to note, again, the House was fully on time waiting for the Senate, which took a little bit longer to arrive. The other thing that I'd like to note in the
Representative Rayfield.
And it's like I said, we have double the workload.
You do, but we have so much respect for you.
Before we start.
And double the square feet to do it.
Yeah, and double the square feet.
That was not our choice. That was the previous speaker's choice.
I'm sure I was in the Senate at that point.
Yeah. May I, before we start, just say happy statehood day? Because today is statehood day to our wonderful state. So I think it's important to acknowledge that at the beginning of our day.
Happy Valentine's Day. I would notice that there's a lot of red on the Senate side. So
I almost wore red today. But I didn't.
The other thing I think the committee should take notice of is the last 2 days, Jonathan Eames has not been in committee. So just please take note of that in your notes.
He scolded.
And with that, it's going to be a regular thing. And with that, we'll go ahead and turn it over to the department.
Good morning, everybody.
Good morning, co-chairs and members of the committee. We're back here again to continue with our slides. To my left is Jenno, who will continue with the financing slides that we left yesterday. We'll come back where I will start talking about major program changes. And to my right is Dr. Jim Rickards, who is Oregon Health Authority's Chief Medical Officer, and will be sharing some information on major program changes as well.
Good morning, co-chairs, members of the committee. I'm Janelle Evans, Budget Director for the Oregon Health Authority. We're going to start on this slide that we left right before yesterday. This is the slide that outlines our federal funds match for Medicaid program. On the top, you'll see the traditional Medicaid non-ACA rate groups. They get, for 15-17, the match rate is 64%. For the average for the biennium, and for 17-19, the average is 63%. 1 percentage point doesn't seem like very much, but in the size of our budget, it can be quite a lot, up to $75 to $100 million for 1 percentage point change. In the middle, there is the ACA expansion adult group. Up until the end of last 2016, we've been getting 100% match. It drops to 95% on the first of January to 95 for the remaining 6 months of this biennium, for a biennial average of 99% federal match. For 17-19, the average match is about 94% for this group. So the total weighted average for 15-17 is about 79% federal match, and for 17-19, it's about 76%. I want to highlight.
Representative Buehler.
Sorry.
Thank you, Chair. So, just so the math is okay with my logic, so for every dollar the state of Oregon spends on the expansion population, how many dollars does the federal government spend in Oregon?
15. So for the expansion population, the 94% match, actually I had the numbers here for, it was very close to my notes, for every dollar for the whole population, for all of our, the weighted average of 76% for 17-19, for every dollar, the feds match it with just over $3. So we have a total of $4 of expenditures where the state is spending one.
For expansion?
I think it's
that's
more
for the expansion?
No, that's not for the expansion. That's for the whole weighted.
Total weighted average.
Okay. How about for the expansion?
Actually, I didn't bring that math with me.
I think it's probably more like 15 to 1. based on Bueller's math, but that's not always accurate.
It's 95 to 5, basically, at this point.
Could you just do it percent?
If it was 95.
So, I see the calculators come out. So I think it's around $15 to $16 to every dollar the state.
On the expansion population.
So what? And so, do we have any idea of how much state income tax revenue is generated from that $15 to $16 of federal spend? I know that's a hard calculation, but I think it's an essential calculation to do. Because I think you see what I'm driving at. If that generates 10% state income tax, we could have a net loss to the system.
I don't.
So if you have $15, say, and this is a fallacious assumption, but say $15. So for $1 state spend, $15. We pull down $15.
Pull down $19.
Okay, so
they're
$19.
In opposition.
Okay, if if those $19 was attributed to income. Taxed at 10% rate, it generates $1.90 in tax revenue.
Yeah.
Now, like I say, that's an error, right? But we should be able to determine roughly how much of that $19 is produced in state income.
It wouldn't be a better way, Mr. Chair, of seeing how much economically it's the gross amount, and you can get that really easy from our economist, of what does the $19 produce for the economy. Because then try to put it in income would be skewed, because part of that may not go into salaries and what have
you. Totally get that. Yeah.
So, but it would, the impact, the economic impact, I believe that you're able to get those numbers a lot easier than you are based on the income tax piece. Yeah.
Because there's also, I mean, those dollars are re-spent, if you will. I mean, any dollar that's paid in salary gets spent on something else.
That's why I start out my preference in my remarks. So you can't say that all $19 comes into income, but a certain percentage will. Doctors and nurses.
Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Chair Rayfield, Co-Chair Rayfield. I think that the economists could calculate it, but in my mind, basically, you take the medical loss ratio by the state's income tax for that, because most of your medical loss ratio calculation is going to go to services. Mm-hmm. It's going to go to salaries for physicians or whatnot, and you take the administrative, even though some of that's in salaries, some of that's in infrastructure.
Right.
So your medical loss ratio times whatever calculation for the state, whether that be 8%, 9%, 6%, 5%, depending on, probably an average of about 7%. So that calculation is pretty easy to come up with.
Yeah, and I think this is probably a conversation between LFO and OHA that could be had offline in terms of combining the data, because they can actually calculate that with the data that OHA could provide.
Right. And Mr. Chair, I can speak with the Legislative Revenue Office.
Yeah.
They do have an economic model that attempts to model more indirect effects.
Yeah. And the only other question that I would have, if for the 1920 biennium, what is the expected average federal match rate? Will that be close to 90% or a little bit higher for the expansion population?
Co-chair, yes, I think it is right around the 90. It goes down to 90 in 2020.
Yeah.
Okay. Right. So in 1921, it's still slightly above 90, because there's still a bit of that transition in the 21-23 biennium.
We averaged 6% for the spring biennium for us and 94 for the feds.
And then in the 2021 biennium, we'll be down to a full 90% at that point.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay.
So that's what it felt.
Please continue.
All right. Were there any other questions on the match rate? Okay. This slide is to give you some information on our OHP Medicaid program historical spending. You'll see the dark line across the top is the caseload. This chart goes back to 2007-09. In that biennium, we had a caseload of about 400,000 people. Our total spend was $4.2 billion, and our general funds were $896 million for that biennium. If you jump ahead a couple biennium to 2011-13, we were at about 600,000 in our caseload. Our total spend was $6.8 billion, and our general funds were less at $853 million. Moving ahead another couple biennium, 2015-2017, our average for this biennium, as we've talked about, is about $1.1 million. Our total spend is $14.8 billion, and our general funds is $1.1 billion. I want to highlight the green in the chart. The light green is the provider assessments. We did have an insurer's managed care and an insurer's tax starting in 2004, and it sunsetted in September of 2013. So the green includes that for that time period, along with the hospital assessment, and then the last two biennium, the green is entirely hospital assessment. I also want to highlight the bright yellow. Those are the designated health state health program funds, also known as DSHP. That was the mechanism that we used in our previous waiver to get the $1.9 billion over the five-year period. Any questions?
Actually, one of the numbers I think would be very helpful, I think, long-term to kind of look at is what, in terms of total funds, what the, you know, if you look at the 1920 with the expected match rate will be the average over that biennium, and then the 2021 expected match rate, obviously we're facing kind of long-term, you know, kind of issues over the next two bienniums, and it would be nice to know what, you know, in terms of maintaining the same service level, you know, what type of a funding shortfall will we have in the next two bienniums that maybe we want to plan for as we start to think about the current biennium so we don't have to readdress some of these issues for the next two long sessions. So I'm kind of thinking proactively ahead on that.
All right. Thank you, Representative Rayfield. We'll get that for you.
Moving on to the next slide, for records, I'm Dr. Varsha Chauhan, Chief Health Systems Officer for Oregon Health Authority. The next few slides we are going to share with you major program changes in the health system division. The first one being the Medicaid expansion under the Affordable Care Act. As we mentioned earlier, we expanded eligibility over 380,000 adults with incomes at 133% of federal poverty level and below. There is a scale on this slide that talks about from the calendar year 2014, 2016, all the way to the subsequent years, 2020 and the subsequent years. For the calendar year 2014 and 16, it was 100%. 2017 goes down to 95%. 2018, 94%. 2019, 93%. And then 2020 and subsequent years, it would be around 90%. It is estimated that 55 million in general fund dollars will be needed for the final 6 months of the 2015-17 biennium to replace the reduced federal medical assistance percentage that we call as FMAP. And FMAP are the percentages used to determine the matching fund rate allocated annually to certain medical and social service programs. It is estimated that the need will be between 275 to 300 million state funds for 2017-19. I would like to walk you through some other major program changes. The first one, what I want to share here, is the new federal authority allows Oregon Health Authority to obtain 100% federal match, not just in services provided to tribal individuals by the tribal health programs, but also on care referred to providers in communities such as hospitals, labs, imaging services, imaging centers, and specialists, as long as the care is managed and the care can be coordinated mandated by the tribal health programs. By the tribal health programs, and the tribe has a contract with the provider they refer the patient to. So this eliminates the state fund share of expenditures since they are funded 100% with federal funds.
So it isn't really a match. It's actually a payment. It's like just like they've been paying us the 100% on the expansion population. Because a match implies that we put in something and they match it back at a certain multiplier, whatever that magic multiplier is. 100% match really isn't a match. It's just like they're going to pay for everything. Is that what you mean?
Co-chairs and Madam Co-chair, yes, that's what exactly. You're absolutely right.
Okay. Just want to be clear. Thank you.
The second bullet point, the care coordination by tribes is work associated with 100% federal match, again, just to make the same point. And that means that in addition to the tribal case management services that are already in place, tribes will more closely coordinate and integrate their care for those with the greatest need and highest utilization to achieve the triple aim objectives of better care, better health, and lower costs. So, moving into the third bullet point on the slide, all the CCOs, the coordinated care organizations, have wraparound funds in their contracts, but utilization of the services is growing at a very rapid pace. It emphasizes coordination by teams across agencies, for example, the Medicaid managed care plans, child welfare, schools, counties, to better coordinate health-related and other services in a child-centered way.
Thank you. What are your quality metrics for the wraparound services for kids? We hear about lack of access to adolescent mental health, to crisis services, to foster care beds, to therapeutic foster homes, to a high rate of abuse in care and at home. What is the role of wraparound in that?
Co-chairs and Senator Gelsa, I do not have that right now in front of me. I will provide that information in detail.
That would be great.
Yes.
Just the metrics and what our what do we describe as the outcome we hope for those wraparound and also the investment would be helpful to know the actual dollar amount.
Sure.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And while you're getting that information, would you also just, because we use the term wraparound a lot without describing what services are embedded in wraparound. So if you could describe what those services are, that would be helpful as well.
And one more follow-up. If there's a way to look at that, across CCOs, I know, for instance, I visited with Chaos and here in Salem, and there was some conversation about the difficulty working with the mental health organization, even with the funding, to get anybody to provide any services. So I'm interested in how the health authority holds accountable the behavioral health organizations to make sure the services that we're paying for are actually available to kids when they need them.
Co-chairs and Senator Nelson and Senator Winters, definitely I'll make sure that we get that information to you all.
Thank you.
Okay. Moving on to psychiatric emergency services, also known as PEZ, the implementation was directed out of previous legislative sessions. Oregon Health Authority's Health System Division with Health Policy Analytics and the Public Health has developed and implemented administrative rules, fee-for-service rates, certification and licensing standards for a new setting of care, specifically to address psychiatric crises that have fallen to the law enforcement and emergency departments in the past. These are very expensive cases, and in previous setting, individuals in crisis have not received immediate active treatment they need to stabilize the crisis. So developed by Oregon hospitals, this setting enables law enforcement to transport these people or persons in crisis to the PEZ facility instead of the emergency room where the environment, mental health practitioners, psychiatric oversight, and procedures stabilize the patient better and more quickly, and where individuals are responsibly transitioned to the next appropriate setting, which is residential day treatment or outpatient. This helps them to maintain successfully.
Excuse me,
Sarah,
I want to go back just a little bit, and can you provide us where there does exist in your data that the ability to actually move the individual from the crisis, from the hospital into resources, into the community? And because, you know, and I'm listening to your narrative, and one of the biggest issues that's there in mental health is that the lack of resources that exist across the state. The ability to move from the crisis situation where an individual have been taken to the hospital, and then from there, what exists in order to move them back into the community other than in the jails. So, you know, that's a whole big problem. So I'd like to know what is and then where you're going.
Co-chairs and Senator Winters, that's an excellent point, and we do have information that I will provide as well in depth.
Yeah, cause one, Mr. Chair, one of the biggest issues that we have, and that is the identification actually of services that exist across all 36 counties, whether we're talking about mental health, whether we're talking drug courts, whether we're talking about, this all sounds wonderful when we're getting into budget, but the reality of it is we've never done a very good job of mapping across this state of what resources, which may exist in Multnomah County, but may not exist in Wheeler County or down in Medford or some other places in the state. So I think it would be wise for us to invest with agencies getting together to do a really good job of mapping the data of what does exist in Oregon and what resources are there so that we don't continue to discuss this issue over here.
Mr. Gilzer.
And Mr. Chair, I think for me what these bring up is the real disconnect between what we say we do, what we say we fund, what we say our policies are, and what Oregonians actually experience. So, you know, I spend every day working with kids and families that are in crisis. It's rare, regardless of where they are in the state, that they can access service, whether they are privately funded or publicly funded. We've got, you know, I've got a kiddo in my district that has been in juvenile detention three times and shackled, and he's 12 years old, and he is not a criminal. He has a mental illness, and he can't get support or help for it. That's not what our policies and budgets say that we do, but that is the true story of mental health in Oregon. So as we get into these conversations, it's beyond the mapping. I would like to get into the weeds of the difference between what we aspire to be, what it says that we are in paper, and what's actually happening and who we're holding accountable to deliver those services. Because right now, the burden of the failure of the system is resting on families that are getting torn apart and little 12-year-old kids that have ankle shackles on because they can't get treatment for their bipolar disorder, and that's just not appropriate.
Yeah. Representative Buehler.
Yeah. Thank you, Representative Rayfield. I completely agree. And the stories from Central Oregon are heart-wrenching. We have kids in mental health crisis coming in the emergency room. Very limited services available. They are literally kept in a white room for sometimes up to 5 to 7 days. Now, if they didn't have a mental health crisis before they showed up in the ER, they do after 7 days in a white room. It's just not acceptable anymore. Yeah. And I've been saying that now for 3 years. And I know what I believe the mapping is important, but it's time to solve this problem. It's enough mapping, enough thinking about it. Someone really needs to take ownership of this with the resources and the skills to solve the problem.
And sorry. Mr. Chair, one more just building on to that. It's the children, it's the complicated populations, the duly diagnosed, intellectually disabled, and mental health populations. We had a task force on the stabilization and crisis units. Our CCOs, these are publicly covered people who are in state care, and they are being turned away from hospitals, from CCOs, being told to call CCOs in other parts of the state, not only to get their mental health care, even for sore throats and strep throats. And we've got state employees that are driving people from Salem to Pendleton to get to a prescriber because we have publicly funded entities that are saying, if you have an intellectual disability, I'm not willing to serve you. And that is a huge problem. Lane County, we know we've got a boarding problem in the hospital for individuals with intellectual and developmental disabilities that also have mental health, both children and adults, and nobody seems to have the answer of who's responsible for it. It really isn't the DD program. They don't provide mental health services, and they can't get help from the health authority when they need it to hold CCOs and others accountable to provide these people the services they desperately need.
Coach Stenner Hayward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just
put on the record that, as those of you who are here in 2012 will remember, when we passed the first authorization for the CCOs, then one of the questions was how are we going to integrate mental health services fully, and the challenge that we face in this state is that historically the counties have held more responsibility for that. Representative Greenleaf Senator Monis Sanderson and I are working on new enabling legislation for the CCOs because it's time, and that's certainly one of the heaviest topics under conversation about how we can affect that, how we can in fact ensure that there is that the CCOs are held appropriately accountable for the mental health care, just as they are held accountable for the physical health care, that there's better coordination between the CCOs. It's inappropriate to fragment the care of these folks, in particular of any individual, frankly, but certainly of these much more vulnerable individuals.
Mr. Chair, this is an important conversation, and this conversation is beyond CCOs.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
This conversation and the reason I mention identification of what exists in the state of Oregon, you cannot send a child someplace or an adult someplace if you don't know that the service exists or not. And we have a situation, whether we're talking about public safety, whether we're talking about mental health, whether we're talking about services for kids, we don't have a clue. We do not have a clue, agency by agency, of what exists in the state to refer entities to. And until we actually do the groundwork planning that says we're funding X in this state in order to provide service for kids, we're all just implementing contracts, sending out money without really any connection to the need. And so I mention that because I have been, you know, talking about not only with mental health, but we've got to do the same thing with public safety. We've got to do the same thing with every place that we send a dollar to know where that dollar and what's available inside of our communities. I think that that's just basic work. It's basic work to know what is before talking about whether it's CCOs, whether it's public safety, or whether it's alcohol and drug treatment. My question the other day was focused on what are we funding and what are the outcomes?
Yeah, and I think the co-chair and myself are looking at the different ways of different types of informational hearings on various topics that may come up, and this might be something that we can talk about.
This is definitely on our list.
Yeah. Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Co-Chair Rayfield. Just briefly, one of the things that I believe would be helpful on this subject, looking back in the statute and what governs the OHA on what they can and can't do, historically we've had the public health and the counties individually contracted to do much of our behavioral mental health services, yet that statute has not been updated since the CCOs have come into effect. And so one of the things that I'm working on with Chair Greenlick is to look at some of those statutes. And one of those is a very simple statute that says OHA can only contract with one entity to provide these services. Yet we have the CCOs and the collaboration of coordinated care, and we haven't updated that statute. So I would encourage OHA to look at that, and I am encouraging them to look at that. And it will probably spark robust discussion about it because there's, you know, certain entities that do that. But we get stuck in a situation in particular counties, Douglas County and, you know, other ones currently going on where we have legal battles going on. OHA is stuck in a contract, and the person trying to get the help provided to them has to wait for these court battles, and OHA's hands are tied. And so I hope that we look at the availability of OHA to have multiple avenues to provide services rather than stuck in one contractual agreement until the court says they can move forward.
Thank you for listening to us. I guess we can continue from here.
No, thank
you. If there's some things that you want to respond, please feel free to, but please continue.
Thank you, co-chairs and members of the committee. Thank you for those excellent points and sharing your thoughts and concerns about the issues on hand. I just wanted to add that with the Behavioral Health Collaborative wrapping up and the report coming out under the guidance and direction of Director Saxton, we recently have convened with Director Leslie Clements here in the back, a team to really start looking at the findings from the Behavioral Health Collaborative. It's not just looking at the mapping, using the mapping tool, but as Senator Winters and Senator Gelser, you brought up some points, really looking at different lifespans from kids, adults, youth, what is exactly happening in the state, and starting to develop some strategies around them. So thank you again for all those comments. Going back to the psychiatric emergency services, this went live last month, which is January of 2017, and we will continue to collect data and do analysis on the report the outcomes to the legislature before the next session. The next bullet point up there is to inform you that Oregon Health Authority is partnering with counties as part of restructuring all the contracts, standardizing reporting statewide, and convening the Behavioral Health Collaborative, standardizing rates and other activities to bring more cohesion, data, and analysis of outcomes statewide. So it kind of connects to what we just were talking about. Compliance, oversight, and quality control.
Let me stop. can you dig a little bit further into that? When he talks about counties to support restructure, you know, I'm just kind of learn a little bit more about that.
So at this time, we are partnering with the counties to restructure the contracts that we have existing. We're looking into them, revising them. We're trying to look at all the reporting and trying to standardize them statewide. We are also looking at all the Behavioral Health Collaborative findings that we have, and along with that, we're standardizing all the rates in other activities. And the focus is, again, to bring cohesion in all the strategies and data so that we are analyzing how things are working or have worked so far in the past.
And maybe you answered it, but kind of the latter half is that you see you're restructuring and revising.
Right.
What is that to what? What is the goal, the aim? Is that kind of the latter half of your explanation?
Yes, it's to bring more cohesion and really to take a step back and see how things have worked so far, what has not worked, what has worked, and where are the gaps, so we can start bringing more cohesion. Look at the data. Does the data we are collecting more accurate? And how is it going towards resulting in the outcomes we are looking for? So are we getting the outcomes we planned for, or is there something we need to relook?
Okay, Senator Gelser.
So would this help with a problem that we have in our district? I represent two counties. One of the counties is known to have very strong mental health services. The other is known to have very poor county-based mental health services. Would this help create some uniformity where a person is not saying, if I'm going to have a mental health crisis, I want to go to the other side of the county line? And would that put the accountability at the OHA to hold the county accountable, or does that rest with the county commissioners?
So I think that... co-chairs and Senator Gelser, I think that's an excellent question. This is something that we are reviewing at this time to see whether it should be OHA. Who would be responsible? It would be the county commissioners. So, again, that is under an analysis, and I can provide further details on what exactly this partnering with counties is going to result into.
Yeah. Oh, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee, I mean, the basic issue behind some of this is CCOs fund Medicaid patients or Medicaid services, and the county mental health programs or, you know, whoever in a county provides services, it basically gets the non-Medicaid piece. Mm-hmm. And I think what the collaborative has struggled with is how do we set up a governance structure locally that will coordinate between the two, and I think that's where they're trying to go with a work plan. So one piece is better control of contracts, but there's got to be the steps beyond that.
And there has to be a line of authority. I know we've tried to chase down for a time, so in one of the counties, just an example, this has happened on more than one occasion, have a constituent that calls that says, I'm going to kill myself today. So I call the county, it's 4:40, and they say, sorry, we close at 5, call again tomorrow. And my response is, no, this person doesn't have until tomorrow, and they say they can only respond if they're able to get there within 20 minutes and otherwise to call the police. I expect something better from a crisis line, from the county crisis line, and yet when I, at the time, contacted the health authority, contacted the county commissioners, it was a lot of pointing of who is it that's responsible for that. In the meantime, I have a constituent in danger, and that level of dysfunction has to have a point of accountability in it, yep, if it's a publicly funded function.
Yeah, Representative Buehler.
Yeah, I completely agree. I see the concept of integrating physical, mental, dental care along with social services is a great concept, but there's a real roadblock almost everywhere in integrating behavioral health care and physical health care. And as I talk to more and more people, it's the county health system is just not integrating adequately, at least from my opinion, and many others in the CCO world, with the CCOs. I don't know what the roadblock is there, if it's a policy problem or a statutory problem or a cultural problem, but I think all of us need to take ownership in breaking down that barriers for the CCOs. You know, there will always be a role for county mental health. I get that. But integrating the delivery closer to the people who really need it is a imperative, I think, for all of us right now.
Yeah. Representative Alonso Leal.
Going to that same bullet and looking at partnering with counties to support restructure local mental health programs. Now, I come from nonprofit background in program development. And so this may be too much into the weeds, but it'll help me understand. When you're looking at a whole restructuring system, and when you're looking at strategic planning and looking at the programs that exist in those counties, are you also looking at it from a service perspective? What's missing and what's not missing? What's needed? And if so, I'd like to understand how you guys are evaluating those services, and if those services are missing, is that because you're asking the constituents, the people who need those services, you're planning around that. Does that make sense?
Right. Co-chairs and Representative Alsonilian, these are good points, and yes, we are looking at it from a service point as well. I'm definitely going to make sure that all this information is brought back to the committee with details on what exactly is the scope, what we are looking, and what is the outcome intended.
Thank you.
Thank you. Let's continue.
And the last point, which I shared a lot of information, was the major program change is the one eligibility system where we open the applicant portal. There's a lot of work still to be done and all the build-outs to optimize that system. With that, I would like to hand it over to Dr. Ricketts, who would share further more program changes related to the Health Evidence Review Commission.
All right. Thanks, Varsha. Good morning. So I'm Jim Rickards, Chief Medical Officer, Oregon Health Authority. And I'd like to give an update on four major program changes impacting the Medicaid population. These are largely expanded benefits that are in place now for our Medicaid population. These are benefits which are for both our CCO and fee-for-service members. First major benefit update is on applied behavioral analysis for autism spectrum disorder. This is also known as ABA services. This is a type of therapy for autism spectrum disorder, which fosters basic skills such as looking, listening, and imitating, as well as fosters complex skills such as reading, conversing, and understanding another person's perspective. Oregon Senate Bill 365, which was passed in 2013, mandated coverage for ABA treatment for commercial health plans starting in January of 2015. The bill also directed the HERC, the Health Evidence Review Commission of the OHA, to evaluate the evidence related to ABA services to consider whether they should be used to treat children who are covered by the Oregon Health Plan. The HERC found good evidence for the effectiveness in the review of ABA services, and coverage for ABA services for Medicaid was started effective January 1 of 2015. Initially, ABA benefits were provided through a carve-out until July 1 of 2016. On July 1 of 2016, CCOs took responsibility of providing ABA services. At the same time, OHA and CCOs entered into a risk corridor arrangement for the first 18 months of CCO implementation of ABA services to help mitigate any financial costs associated with these benefits. Basically, the risk corridor means if expenses for providing services are significantly higher for the CCOs than the revenue they received, the OHA will pay an amount back to the CCOs after the 18-month period. However, if expenses are significantly lower than the revenue received by the CCOs will rebate an amount back to the OHA after an 18-month period. The risk corridor settlement is based on the revenue the CCO receives just for the ABA services over the 18-month service period, and the only allowable expenses will be calculated from the CCO's ABA claims data that's submitted through MMIS. In general, there's two categories of ABA services delineated by age. There are services for children ages 1 to 12, and then there are services for children ages 13 and over. For children ages 1 to 12, they're eligible to receive both comprehensive and focused ABA services. Comprehensive ABA services address core symptoms of autism, including social and communication impairments, along with restrictive and repetitive behaviors, and the focused APA therapy addresses specific behaviors, whereas for individuals 13 and over, only focused ABA therapy is allowed for. What's the length of coverage? Based on the HERC review of the evidence, continued coverage for all ABA services should be evaluated every 6 months, and it requires documented progress towards treatment goals. There are, however, no specified limits on treatment intensity, such as the number of hours a week an individual can receive therapy or for the duration. The evidence review indicated there was no optimal intensity or dose response in the literature. The state mandate for regulated commercial plans does require up to 25 hours per week of therapy and only covers children who initiate treatment before age of 9. So that's the update on ABA services. Maybe I'll pause there. Any questions? No? Okay. Some of the ongoing work related to ABA services, we're currently updating the rules related to this. The OHA is actively working with our CCOs on applying the HERC guideline note. The risk corridor ends in December of 2017. OHA will process a reconciliation by mid-2018 and settle with the CCOs at that time. 2016 ABA costs will be evaluated as part of the 2018 rate development process. OHA is doing a number of things to help support the treatment of autism and ABA services throughout the state. Just yesterday, we hosted a learning collaborative at our monthly QHOC meeting to help CCOs and providers understand the various ABA resources across the state, identify best practices, and discuss challenges and barriers for service treatment. All right, next update, high-cost drug therapy for hepatitis C. Hepatitis C is a viral infection affecting mainly the liver. It's transmitted through bodily fluids, namely through injection drug use in today's day and age. In 2011, a new class of medications called the direct-acting antivirals, or DAAs, were approved by the FDA and shortly came to market after that. This class of drugs dramatically changed the treatment landscape of hepatitis C. Currently, there are several DAAs on the markets from various manufacturers, creating some competition and helping to bring down prices. Prior to the DAAs, treatment for hepatitis C was often said to be worse than the disease itself. A drug called interferon was used to treat hepatitis C, which caused severe flu-like symptoms, and a number of people were not able to complete the treatment. Hepatitis C as a disease is one that progresses through various stages. There's essentially 5 stages, 0 through 4. With the increasing stages, there's increasing risk of developing liver cancer, liver failure, and a need for a liver transplant. One interesting thing to note with hepatitis C is about 15...
Question you may get there, but what's the universe? What's the population universe for hep C?
So in Oregon, with our Medicaid population, we estimate there's between 11 to 14,000 individuals with hepatitis C. It is widely known, though, that hepatitis C is underdiagnosed. The Public Health Division put out a report several years ago that estimated that in Oregon, up to 95,000 individuals could potentially be infected with hep C. But again, for Medicaid, we know about 11 to 14,000. So.
Is that forecasting pretty on target? Do you know?
Yeah, for the Medicaid numbers, yeah. Because
that's a 3,000 range.
Oh yeah, I guess you're right. It is a range. So, yeah. So we could work to get more precise numbers. So. So what is the current state of treatment for hepatitis C? In 1999, for Medicaid, the treatment of viral hepatitis C was moved into the funded region on the prioritized list for the first time, with a guideline note noting the use of interferon for treatment of hep C. In August of 2014, the HERT considered a guideline note that would establish appropriate candidacy for treatment of OHA patients with the DAAs. Related to this, some CCOs submitted testimony that they would prefer to manage the coverage criteria of these drugs themselves. With that, the HERC elected not to pursue the topic of DAAs and made no changes to the prioritized list. Since then, the fee-for-service P&T committee, along with CCOs, have managed coverage criteria for the treatment and prescription of DAAs, and OHA has worked to ensure compliance with CMS guidance for the prescription of these drugs. The P&T committee for the fee-for-service population evaluates prescription drugs placed on the state's preferred drug list based on safety, effectiveness, and cost, and it used this model to evaluate how DAAs were to be used. Since 2014, the P&T committee has reviewed DAAs on multiple occasions and has progressively expanded coverage to additional stages of disease. Based on the P&T recommendations to OHA, currently Medicaid authorizes for all stages 3 and 4 of disease to be treated, with limited coverage of stages 0, 1, and 2 for individuals with comorbidities such as organ transplants or who are pregnant. OHA has submitted a policy option package to request additional funding to expand treatment to all of stage 2 disease. Regarding the cost of these drugs, when these drugs first came to market, the prices were well over $100,000 per course of treatment. This gets to Medicaid drug purchasing. Drug purchasing by Medicaid is very complicated. There's a large federal program called the Medicaid Drug Rebate Program, which is designed to help ease the financial burden of these drugs for states. Drugs are when it comes to drug purchasing for Medicaid, states don't necessarily negotiate a lower price. They try to negotiate a larger supplemental rebate to decrease the total net costs. It makes it somewhat difficult to communicate than drug purchasing. And there's actually two different types of rebates available. There's the standard drug rebate, which is 23% for brand name drugs. That's under the Medicaid Drug Rebate Program. So basically, if a manufacturer enters in the Medicaid Drug Rebate Program, then they have to provide the state that 23% rebate on the drugs.
Let me stop you there for a second. Okay. Senator Herbert.
Yeah.
And maybe you're about to get this, but to be clear, we don't get to keep all the rebates, right?
Correct. Some of the rebate has to be given back to the federal government, so we don't get to keep all of that. And the other challenge with the rebates is it's a percent on the price of the drug. Uh-huh. So what happens then is that the manufacturers bring drugs to market at higher and higher costs. So instead of, say, bringing a drug to market at $10,000 and giving a 23% rebate on $10,000, the drug is brought to market at $100,000. And so you still have to just pay the 23% rebate, but it's now on $100,000, and our net costs are higher. So that's one type of rebate. That's a standard Medicaid drug rebate. We also negotiate what are called supplemental rebates with manufacturers. And the question I often receive is, why doesn't Oregon work with other states to try to get better prices for the drugs it buys? Well, the answer is we don't negotiate the price of the drugs. We negotiate the rebate. And we work through an entity called the SSDC, the Sovereign State Drug Consortium, which is a group of 11 states who come together and pool over 5 million Medicaid lives to negotiate the best supplemental rebates possible.
But, okay, if I may, Mr.
Please,
Chair.
Please.
Yeah. I'll start with the more important question first. Why do you choose to negotiate the percent rebate rather than the price? I mean, if you look at pharmacy benefit manufacturers, or if I understand correctly, the multi-state Department of Corrections compact negotiates price, not rebate. What's
up with that?
Yeah, so negotiating, so this gets to the complexity of drug purchasing. There is some negotiation of price. So in Oregon, our model is our CCO model. The CCOs farm out the purchase of pharmacy to PBM, pharmacy benefit managers. Pharmacy benefit managers do negotiate based on price. CCOs are somewhat disconnected from that. The state has its own PBM that it uses, or PBA, actually, Pharmacy Benefit Administrator, Hewlett-Packard Enterprises, where we are able to negotiate on price. But a lot of the negotiation happens on the rebate side, but there is some of the price side.
So if I may, Mr. Chair, just to be clear, then the CCOs get rebates too, or they only get the new price that they've negotiated through their PBMs?
Yeah, so the way it typically works is the PBMs will receive any supplemental rebates, and those are passed on to CCOs in various forms. Now, the rebates that we negotiate as a state through the SSDC, those are for drugs placed on our statewide preferred drug list, which is for our fee-for-service population. But we negotiate those rates based on our entire Medicaid population. With hepatitis C now, what we've seen is that the challenge is we negotiate these supplemental rebates to place drugs on our preferred drug list for the fee-for-service population. However, we had a experience where CCOs were not necessarily purchasing the drugs which were on the PDL that resulted in the lowest net cost. The reason being that a CCO might have a lower acquisition cost for a drug than the state. And this gets a little complicated. I'll try to explain it. But say there's a drug that costs $100,000 to buy for the state. We may have a supplemental rebate for $90,000. So the net cost is only $10,000. The CCO, however, might be able to buy that same drug for only $50,000. So why would they want to buy a drug for $100,000? They don't receive that rebate. The state does. So they're motivated to buy that drug for $50,000. Not the $100,000 drug that really has a net cost of $10,000. That's the disconnect.
So I know, Senator, but I want to make sure that bear with me for just a second.
I didn't make the rules.
I know, but that's the question.
Yeah.
Who made the rules?
Yeah.
Is that us? Because we can fix that.
Right. Well, and so with that example where the CCOs are buying a drug with a lower acquisition cost to them that might not be the lowest net cost to the state, what we've done to address that is we've created a risk corridor. And with that, we now have a contract in place with the CCOs where they have to buy the drugs on our PDL that result in the lowest net cost to the state, and then we agree to make them whole. So now they will buy that drug for $100,000. We'll give them the $100,000 because we know we're getting a $90,000 rebate on the back end, and we're only going to pay $10,000 in net costs as a state.
So, okay, we need to have some more conversation about this, Mr. Rickards,
yeah.
Dr. Rickards, because I think that part of what I don't understand is why CCOs can all contract individually with different PBMs when they're really serving Medicaid. They're all serving state Medicaid patients. So that's a piece I don't understand. And I think I don't want to belabor this any further, but, and I know Senator Moore.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'll just go back a little bit, and I'm quite familiar with the compact that the Department of Correction is with, because it's a multi-state compact, and therefore their drugs, the drug cost is lower. For several years, I had to go through this debate with somebody else that wanted them to be a part of the state purchasing pool. Is there feasibility for Oregon to actually join other states in a pool? Because it seems to me, we know in doing the analysis of what's occurring in DOC that those costs of their pharmaceuticals is costing us less because they are a part of a compact, with multiple states.
Yeah. So that SSDC, that's already one pool where we negotiate rebates to get a lower net cost. We also have OPDP, the Oregon Prescription Drug Program, which
doesn't compete with DOC, but by the way.
Yeah, which a number of employers in the state take part in, and
Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, and in OPDP now, we have our first CCO, Eastern Oregon CCO, participating. Mm-hmm. Now, I mention OPDP because this is another way or another vehicle we have to partner with other states. So OPDP is part of the Northwest Drug Consortium. Washington State is part of the Northwest Drug Consortium. So OPDP and Washington State work together in the Northwest Drug Consortium to help negotiate better prices on drugs. In Washington State, their Medicaid population is part of that Northwest Drug Consortium. We're starting to see more interest in that from our other CCOs in addition to Eastern Oregon CCO. So that is another way that we can partner with at least one other state in helping to negotiate prices.
So there's a real follow-up, Mr. Chair. So there's a real value to actually, you know, maybe work to try to partner with the state of Washington, particularly since they're doing Medicaid, with them and probably other states. I would look at Idaho and some of the others in a compact similar to how Department of Corrections is actually a part of their compact. Because I don't think we're alone in this whole conversation about pharmaceutical pricing and the cost. And it just seems to me the more that we can have conversation with, like, Washington and others to see what we can do, particularly Washington, because there's so many other things that we do with Washington, mm-hmm. that it might be a lot easier.
And your professional expertise, as you've been doing this over years, is there any way to make it a little bit more complicated?
I could share that with you.
Okay. we'll take that offline. Yeah. But yeah. Please continue.
Yeah. So, you know, I think the take-home message, though, is we do negotiate with other states, but with OPDP, I think if we can bring our CCOs into the fold more, there's going to be more opportunity potentially to do that.
I'm really sorry, Mr. Rip, but I realized that I don't actually think I got an exact answer to my other question, which is why is it that the CCOs can go through their own choices of PBMs and don't have to come through OPDP or some analogous system?
Yeah, well, so as you know, we pay CCOs a fixed global budget to pay for all medical services, and then they can go out and use that to contract with not only professional networks but also entities such as PBMs or behavioral health networks as they want. Pharmacy is not specifically addressed, you know, in rule in terms of how it needs to be contracted or, mandating the use of OPDP or any other program like that. So the risk corridor we have in place was kind of our first attempt to align the purchasing of CCOs with one specific medication with our state PDL that would result in a lower net cost. You know, I think as we move forward, there's potential to do that with other drug classes. But the DAAs for treating Hep C was very much an exception, and so that's why we kind of moved ahead with that drug class first. So,
okay.
I hope that answers your question.
Yeah, it does. Okay. It makes me wonder whether that's the right way for us to be doing that piece of it, but we'll think about that.
I think you could like to follow up, because you mentioned a very hot topic, and going back in time when we created the CCOs and we also added behavioral health, and it's no secret in this building that part of the negotiation that I did with the good Dr. Kitzhaber when he was still here, the good governor, was that we allow them, the CCOs, enough time in order to become a lot more skilled at in pharmaceutical side on with behavioral health, recognizing that this was new to some of the CCOs and managing that. So that's where that carve-out for the mental health medications came into play. You know, and I believe I testified before Greenick's committee that I was not willing to put a play Russian roulette with this population, simply because we were talking about saving $1 million. And until the CCOs actually were at a point to where they were feeling very, you know, skilled and comfortable with this population, that I would continue with that drumbeat of saying, pharmaceuticals and what we prescribe becomes very important to the health and well-being of individuals. And I know that probably, you know, the benefit management group is probably looking at all of that as well, and to make certain that we're getting it right.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you. All right, moving on from hepatitis C, treatment of back pain. As many are aware, an opioid epidemic is afflicting both Oregon and the nation. This is both with prescription and non-prescription opioids. Back pain is actually a large driver of prescription opioid use in the Medicaid population. In 2013, Oregon had 50,000 members with diagnosed back pain, 30,000 of which were treated with opioids. This was largely due to the fact that a number of other therapies were not above the funding line on the prioritized list. As a result of new evidence and efforts to help curtail opioid use, the HRC evaluated the treatment of back pain and developed a new guideline note 56, for the non-interventional treatment of back and spine pain. And so beginning on July 1 of 2016, there is expanded coverage for additional services to treat back pain, such as physical therapy, occupational therapy, chiropractic manipulation, osteopathic manipulation, acupuncture, yoga, and cognitive behavioral therapy. Additionally, the HRC also developed Guideline Note 60, which placed limits on opioid prescribing for back pain. The major part of this included the need to have a taper plan in place through 2017 for individuals who had been on long-term opioid use, with an end date of January 1 of 2018, with expectation that individuals on long-term opioid use for back pain would not be using the opioids by January 1st of 2018. OHA has worked closely with CCO pharmacy and medical directors to share knowledge and assist in the implementation of this guideline note. In May of this year, the HRC will be reassessing the impact of guideline note 56 and 60 and make any modifications as appropriate. And then finally, expansion of dental services for non-pregnant adults. As of July 1, 2016, expanded dental services were available as a result of funding allocations. This restored services to levels previously offered between 2003 and 2009. The expansion was a result of legislative action with additional funding allocated in a budget note. This was not a HRC decision. Dental services now include additional preventative dental services, such as full mouth debridement every 2 years. Previously, this was every 3 years. Basic periodontal services, basic restorative services such as the placement of stainless steel crowns, as well as the provision of removable prosthodontics or dentures. What does the future hold for dental benefits? Dr. Bruce Austin, our dental director, is now in his second year of work. We've recently completed an oral health roadmap to help guide the OHA internally in improving dental care, and the state health improvement plan has a number of dental elements that Dr. Austin is working on. So that's all I have. Thank you.
Thank you.
With that, we would like to shift into the other part of the presentation, where we would like to talk more about what's the opportunities and the key performance metrics. So I'll have our Medicaid director, Lori Coyner, up here, and our health policy analytics director, Leslie Clements, join me.
Good morning. For the record, I am Lori Coyner, Medicaid Director for the Oregon Health Authority and the state. And good morning to the co-chairs on the committee. I have one slide. That's a picture up here. And so I'm just going to tell a little story about our waiver. Feel free to interrupt me as I go, because otherwise I will. I can talk for a long time on this topic. So for those of you that are new to the committee, I'm going to start by talking a little bit about what a waiver is and why we have it, and some brief history so that it will set you up to understand recent events. We have our state in Oregon, we have what's called an 1115 demonstration waiver. And what does that mean? The federal government, or Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, provides states the opportunity to apply for a waiver. And what that does is you waive federal law in order to develop a new delivery system with the stipulation that, first off, they have to agree to the details, and the second thing is it has to be budget neutral. So you have to convince the federal government that you will either spend no more money than if you used a traditional Medicaid program or spend less. And it's also called a demonstration because it's time limited. They typically are 3 years. We've usually almost always had 5-year waivers, and they require you to conduct an evaluation at the end so that you can demonstrate that you're offering better care and that you're keeping costs down. About, I think, 38 states have 1115 waivers. However, only a handful, most of those are on a really small subset of the population, or they're very defined. There are just a handful of states that have a full comprehensive waiver like ours that covers the entire Medicaid population for Oregon. In 1994, we also continue to be pioneers. We were really one of the first states in the country to have a comprehensive waiver. Our first was in 1994. We've had a waiver ever since, every 3 to 5 years. And 1994 established what's called the prioritized list of services. That was really, and developed the Oregon Health Plan. So we've had a continuous waiver since then. The most recent waiver was approved in July 1st of 2012, and that waiver was historic for a couple of reasons. One is it established our coordinated care model. We stood up 16 CCOs with that waiver. We ensured the federal government that we would keep our costs to no more than 3.4% rate of growth, which is a 2% reduction than what was projected to be annual rate of growth in expenditures. And we also received a big funding mechanism, and it was on one of the earlier slides, called the Designated State Health Programs, or we often call it DSHP. And what that did was provide an extra $1.9 billion to the state to stand up CCOs in the model. That was a 5-year demonstration. It was set to expire on June 30th of 2017. And if you want to renew your waiver, you need to submit an application about a year ahead. Last spring, we were working hard to come up with what that was going to look like. There was definitely a strong push from stakeholders and OHA and the governor's office to continue with the model. So we continue with CCOs and our coordinated care model. We believe that it's been successful. We've held costs down. We've met our metrics. And so we wanted to continue that. We submitted the renewal application in the summer and started to have conversations on policy issues with CMS we had started on some of the policy pieces as early as March and then continued through. We had to push hard to start those conversations because the folks in CMS knew there was a election coming and a definite administration change. And so there was some negotiating around what was going to be talked about before that and after in the subsequent time. At the election, we decided to push to have the waiver renewed before the inauguration for a couple of reasons. One is the timing. So with a waiver that was going to expire in June and you have a new administration coming in, it takes, we don't have confirmations yet. CMS is really kind of on hold in terms of making decisions right now, and it takes months for that whole big system to get going. So we were very worried about trying to negotiate a waiver when the first probably 4 months of the year were going to be kind of stalled out. So The second reason is we wanted to lock in our coordinated care model while we could with the administration that had originally approved our first waiver. So we received that approval on January 12th, 2017. It's a 5+ year renewal in the sense that it expires on June 30th, 2022. And so we get a little wiggle room there. And we had some visions, and we got most of those, and there are some things that we just did not have time to negotiate. So I can talk about those right now. We asked for extra funding like we had received before to mostly work to expand the coordinated care model. So I'm going to point to the picture that we have up on the screen here. The very first, I guess, bubble is pre-2012, where we had a fragmented system. Behavioral, oral, and physical health care services were not integrated. And the vision was the coordinated care model that's in the middle. So the big piece on that was the coordination of those types of services.
Yes, Senator.
Thank you. Ms. Klinner, I don't mean to put you on the spot, but given the conversations we've been having, how close do you think personally, I'm just asking for your personal sense, how close do you think we are to an ideally integrated model for delivery of all four of these domains?
Senator Steiner Hayward and members of the committee, we acknowledge in the waiver that we made lots of progress, and we certainly didn't get all the way to a fully integrated system. And that was part of our, I think, push to ask for some additional funding to help make that happen. And one of the key goals in the waiver is to continue to integrate physical, oral, and behavioral health services. And so we made lots of progress, I don't think all the way there yet.
All right, and with that, I think we're going to go ahead and stop for today, and we have a grant request that we need to get to, and so we can resume at this point, kind of starting off with a slide tomorrow.
Okay.
So I do apologize to interrupt, but we do need to get the grant application done.
Thank you.
Thank you guys very much. All right, so with that, we'll go ahead and open up a work session on the Oregon Health Authority Health Policy and Analytics. But we keep it open throughout the...
I'm sorry.
So open up a work session on the Oregon Health Authority Health Policy and Analytics grant, and we'll turn it over to Ms. Hayes.
Mr. Chair, Madam... members of the committee, OHA has requested permission to apply for a federal grant that would provide significant more funding for dealing with our opioid crisis. And Mike Morris is here to do a brief overview.
Please, Mr. Morris.
Good morning. My name is Mike Morris, and I'm the Behavioral Health Policy Administrator with the Oregon Health Authority. And I'm here to just give you the highlights of this grant, but also just to also talk about the other initiatives, other grants that we have, and how this grant fits in with this. First of all, this grant was part of the Cures Act, which was federal legislation that was passed in December. It passed very quickly and was signed into law quickly, and actually within less than a week of it being signed into law, the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration released this grant. So it came out pretty quickly in December, and then we have been working very hard to respond to that grant request. This is a formula grant, so what that means is there is a larger sum of money, and they are dividing it up among the states and territories that are eligible for this funding. And then, so we, based upon the calculations, we are going to be receiving approximately $6.5 million a year over 2 years for that. So it is not a competitive grant. So if we submit an application and request those funds and have a plan that is acceptable, then we will get those funds over the next 2 years. So the There are a couple of grants that are currently in process. There is in Public Health Division, there's a prescription drug overdose grant, and a lot of the activities that Dr. Rickards was talking about as far as prescribing practices and guidelines that came out of that grant, and they're still working, as he said, on the implementation of that grant. And then we have medication-assisted treatment for opioid addiction grant, and that is housed in Health Services Division, and that is to expand the access to medication-assisted treatment. Part of that is using Project Echo, which is a video peer mentoring program for physicians. And regarding certain issues, and this particular issue is on opioid use disorders and prescribing of medication assisted therapies. So one of the things that we are responsible to do is make sure that we are leveraging the current activities. And so there has already been, prior to this grant being released, opioid workforce or work group that has been working on this issue and coming up with plans for the state. So when we received this grant application or notification, we went to that group and then looked at the things that were being planned and what can we do to expand on the things that we're already looking at. So the things that we are working on is, one is the prescription drug overdose grant in some of the areas of the state expires in this year, I think the summer of this year. And so this grant, if we were to receive it, would expand that beyond 2017. So there's that. We are going to look at expanding. I talked about Project Echo, primarily for physicians. We're looking at expanding that to nurse practitioners. There's some legislation that permitted that that was passed at the federal level. So we're going to use Project Echo to expand the prescribers to increase access, especially in rural and frontier communities.
And Mr. Morris,
so there are other things that...
Mr. Morris, we're running a little bit short on time. We do have the written materials in front of us. And so, but before, I just want to make sure, are there any questions of the group here for Mr. Morris? Okay. Seeing that, if we could just turn to the CFO analyst, Ms. McDonald. And,
Thank you, Chair Rayfield, Chair Steiner Hayward, members of the committee, Tom McDonald with the Chief Financial Office, and we recommend to approve the request.
Okay, very good. And Mr. Morris, before we move, is there anything else you want to add?
I think that covers the other things that are covered in the letter.
Okay, so. Very good. I do apologize. So we're just running a little short on time. And Ms. Ames.
Mr. Chair, the Legislative Fiscal Office recommends approval of the request to apply for a grant from SAMHSA for $6.6 million per year for 2 years to address the opioid crisis.
And it would be fantastic to get a motion to approve the LFO recommendation.
Mr. Chair, I move approval of the LFO recommendation.
Co-Chair Steiner Hayward moves the LFO recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing no discussion, is there any objection to the motion? Seeing no objection, motion carries. And we just need a carrier to full.
You can do the ones.
I would be happy to carry us to full.
You get to carry the first one.
I'll take the honors. With that, we'll go ahead and close the work session, and we'll go ahead. Is there anything else before we adjourn the meeting, Ms. Ames?
Members of the committee, I will warn you that we don't really anticipate full meeting for a couple weeks. It's a little hard for them to meet while we're doing the trip. So this will turn up at full whenever they meet next, it won't be Friday.
Okay.
And it's just the two of you that are on the
Senator
call.
Winters.
Senator Winters?
Yes.
Okay. So the three of us get to carry lots and lots of stuff this year.
And then if we wish to join you on the roadshow, do we just need to let somebody know ahead
of time? Mr. Maxey in the president's office.
Perfect.
For our side of the table.
All right. Anything else? Saints? We're good? All right. We'll go ahead and adjourn the meeting. We'll see you all tomorrow.